sunshine was more in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, the show that takes its name from Karl Marx's figure for the revolution, working away underground, changing the terrain of everyday life from below. We come to you every Monday morning at 9 here on KBOO Portland and streaming everywhere on KBOO.fm. This is volunteer-powered, non-commercial, listener-sponsored, full-strength community radio for Portland, Oregon, the Pacific Northwest, and the world. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Our theme song today was performed by Clayton and Ernie and Joe. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. Today on the Old Mole Variety Hour, book mole Larry Bolden will be reviewing the novel When God Was a Rabbit by Sarah Winman. Bill Resnick talks with Norman Solomon about U.S. militarism, including the continued NATO encirclement of Russia, who it benefits, and how it can be stopped. And today is the first day of KBOO Spring Membership Drive, and the first day of the rest of your life as a KBOO member. So we'll also be hearing from our friends John and Ani about the joys of KBOO. Plus, we'll have Norman Solomon's book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, as a bonus gift if you become a KBOO member or renew your membership during this show. You'll be able to find the link to today's show and its segments at our show page on the KBOO website, along with more information about segments. It usually takes a day or two after broadcast for us to post all that, but if you subscribe to our show, the links will be delivered to you when they're ready. Visit the Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm to subscribe, as well as to find links to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or to contact us with questions, comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. Before we dive into the rest of the show, I want to say a few things about the current media landscape.
Bill Resnick's guest on today's Old Mole is Norman Solomon, and it's worth reflecting on the value of Solomon's work in the current media landscape. Solomon is a longtime associate of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, which produces the radio show Counterspin, which you can hear on KBOO every 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Friday from 5:30 to 6. Solomon is also a founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which works to provide alternative sources for journalists. Providing criticism of mainstream media and resources for mainstream journalists is hugely important, especially since media consolidation means there are few sources providing checks and balances on news. By 2012, 90% of all media in the U.S. was owned by 6 corporations, down from 50 in 1983. That affects cultural as well as news offerings, so that, for instance, 80% of the station music playlists matched. So you'd hear the same thing pretty much everywhere, all the time, unless you were listening to community radio. And because, as the Free Press notes, the FCC further slashed its media ownership limits in 2017, corporations are now permitted to own the daily newspaper and multiple TV and radio stations in the same market, which gives people even fewer voices and viewpoints and far less local news coverage, unless, of course, they have access to community radio. It's true that this consolidation of media ownership coexists with the rise of social media and a flood of content. But that flood can itself be a problem, as writer and cultural critic Soraya Roberts comments in an essay posted on Longreads last month. Quote, "The web once made something of a biblical promise to give all of us a voice, but in the ensuing flood, only a few bobbed to the top. With increased diversity, this hasn't changed. There are more diverse voices, but the same ones float up each time." By flooding, Roberts means the practice of unleashing a mass torrent of the same stories by the same storytellers at the same time, making it almost impossible for anyone but the same select few to rise to the surface. Theoretically, the democratization everyone continues to harp on persists. Anyone with internet access can produce content. But what's not democratic is the dissemination. There are niche sites for any of your niche needs and niche corners of mainstream sites, sort of. But with these sites progressively dwindling and the ones left behind scrambling to secure their place, which is secured by clicks, still, they gravitate toward what's trending. In the cacophony of content and conversation around that content, the most familiar voices at the largest, fastest, trendiest outlets carry the farthest. According to SimilarWeb, which tracks website statistics, only 5 sites dominate around 50% of the newspaper traffic in the U.S., end quote. Writing in the Columbia Journalism Review last year, Ravi Somaya points out that with every news outlet now plugged into the same streams, most notably social media, online newspapers now respond to a borderless audience and a perpetual 24-hour news cycle. Like news channels seeking clicks above all, they push twice as many stories as their paper ancestors, often with a much smaller staff. Somaya suggests that, quote, the net effect is to speed up and amplify the groupthink that has plagued journalists, and to deny audiences context. Deeper reporting is lost in the noise. Readers inundated by streams of stories tailored for them, with similarly sharpened headlines ruthlessly tested to work on social media, develop a kind of fatigue. Those who seek to confuse, dissemble, and sow distrust find fertile ground. Faced with a sea of headlines in every permutation, even the most determined mind rebels and begins to dismiss it as all noise. End quote. And Roberts argues that, especially in the area of cultural production, much of it is noise. Quote, the projected utopia of infinite content has revealed itself to be just an infinite reconfiguration of the same things over and over. On Netflix recently, you could choose from 6 different street-level Marvel superhero shows set in New York City. IndieWire critic David Ehrlich recently noted that since Jordan Peele's Get Out shook the culture in 2017, only 7 original movies, neither spin-offs nor adaptations nor remakes, have topped the box office, one of which was also by Peele. We shift around the same ideas and the same people, creating an over-recognized few and an under-recognized many. Roberts also notes that, quote, establishing the terms of the cultural conversation has become increasingly automated. With the rise in algorithmic recommendations, there's been a decline in sales diversity. We're increasingly consuming the same books, the same movies, the same shows. In A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, Kartik Hosanagar reports that 1/3 of the product choice at Amazon are driven by algorithms, while at Netflix it's around 80%. These algorithms are taste reflectors meant to reinforce your palate, end quote. Unfortunately, while that might be true for entertainment at Amazon and Netflix, on YouTube the algorithms do drive viewers toward increasingly right-wing propaganda. Alt-right YouTubers build audience by exploiting the algorithms that respond to engagement without considering any evaluation of quality or accuracy. And outrage is engaging. As researcher Rebecca Lewis reported last year in Data and Society, quote, YouTube monetizes influence for everyone, regardless of how harmful their belief systems are. The platform and its parent company have allowed racist, misogynist, and harassing content to remain online, end quote. Lewis identifies a network of academics, media pundits, and internet celebrities who function as political influencers who adopt the techniques of brand influencers to build audiences and sell them on far-right ideology, in a deliberate attempt to radicalize users by pulling them into a vortex of reactionary content. Their cross-promotion of ideas forms a general opposition to feminism, social justice, or left-wing politics. When viewers engage with this content, it's framed as lighthearted, entertaining, rebellious, and fun. This fundamentally obscures the impact that issues have on vulnerable and underrepresented populations, the LGBTQ community, women, immigrants, and people of color. Social networking among right-wing influencers on YouTube makes it easy for audience members to be incrementally exposed to and come to trust ever more extremist political positions, Lewis writes. And Google, of course, happily monetizes all of that engagement and traffic with ads. Michael Nyman, writing in Truthout, notes that weaponizing of social media by fascist forces affects all of us. Considering the 2016 elections, he points out that, quote, while Russian interference was real and documented, its impact paled in comparison to the more effective propaganda campaigns launched by Breitbart and Fox. During the 2016 election season, fraudulent sites and fascist posts got more Facebook reads than the top 19 news sites reporting verifiable reality put together. Nyman calls this World War F. It's a false reality fueled by Facebook, fascism, and fraud. End quote. So what can you do to oppose fascism and support accurate news, historical context, and the values of feminism, social justice, and left politics? Support your non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. Later today, we'll hear from Bill Resnick and Norman Solomon and Bookmole Larry Bolden. But now it's time for Bill Resnick's conversation with Norman Solomon.
Hi, Norman Solomon. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello, thank you.
Norman Solomon's an American journalist, media critic, author, activist, also a KBOO alumnus. His dozen books include War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Also the book Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. He's very active, speaking, writing a vast number of op-eds and articles over the years in numerous outlets, left and liberal. He's been affiliated with Fairness and Accuracy in Media, also founded the Institute for Public Accuracy and the organization Roots Action. He's put his body on the line in demonstration, and he's run for and came close to winning a California seat in the Congress. And he was a great Bernie supporter, still is. Norman, you ran Bernie's operation at the Democratic National Convention. What was your role there?
Well, the Bernie Delegates Network that I coordinated was completely independent of, although supportive of, the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016. And as a delegate for Bernie Sanders, I was coordinating that network.
As to Norman Solomon's history, again, he's a KBOO alumnus, indeed got his media start right here in this radio station. Is that right?
Yes, actually, I learned how to sit and speak in front of a microphone at KBOO.
Well, you've really gotten good at it. Anyway, I didn't have to twist his arm to contribute Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, to contribute it as a premium for people who become members of KBOO today during our spring membership drive. Norman, let's begin. Today, the U.S. military spends more wealth, has more power than near the whole the rest of the world combined. The U.S. is unchallenged militarily. There's no threat to this country, yet still they remain hugely aggressive, as today in Latin America and Venezuela, and also moving East European bases right to the border with Russia. So, Norman, tell us about NATO and its continuous encirclement of Russia, drawing the noose tighter. Later we can talk about the purpose of U.S. aggression, that is why they are doing it. But first, NATO and Russia and what's happening.
Really, NATO, having just marked its 70th anniversary, is something that has, on its ostensible purpose, outlived its goals, but it's not a defensive operation, as you note. It actually has engaged now in a partnership with the country of Colombia, is talking now about doing that with Brazil. It is, after expanding post the fall of the Berlin Wall, to a dozen new countries moving eastward. It's now talking about bringing into membership Georgia, again, up on the Russian border, not the first expanded NATO country to be on the border. And I ask people, what would it seem like if a Russian-led military alliance brought into membership Canada and Mexico? Can you imagine the response out of Washington? And yet, we're encouraged to discount and ignore the concerns that the Russian government has in terms of the expansion of NATO. So this is a extremely dangerous development. It has been accelerating in the last 20 years. It began under President Clinton, it gone through Bush, gone through Obama. This is a mess. It's dangerous. It goes to the underlying militarism of U.S. policy, and what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex is running rampant.
Yeah. NATO is part of the sort of the U.S. international military effort and plays an important role. It also, though, has another, whatever, 700, 800 bases around the world and in most countries on Earth, many islands in the Pacific and Atlantic. These bases are also sort of exporting, are used as ways of training police and militaries, sometimes through treaties with countries. We really are this international military force now that's very aggressive in trying to mold the world towards its aims. Tell us about that just for a second.
The reality is that, as you allude to, the United States has approximately 800 overseas military bases. The rest of the world combined has under 40. Russia, last time I checked, had about 12 or so overseas out of their own country military bases. So Russia has a dozen, the United States has 800, and we're supposed to believe that Russia is the big threat to peace. We have, you know, an underlying challenge, which is cultural, media, and political, including electoral, where the vast majority of members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, are just on the warfare state train. And to be specific about it, if you have a congressperson like Earl Blumenau, or if you have Senators Wyden and Merkley, where do they stand on this? Well, you know, Merkley is probably better on these issues, but all of these members of Congress need to be pushed. Ron Wyden is a militarist on these issues. And so it's not just an abstraction of what the Pentagon is doing or something far away in Washington. We all have the capacity to challenge members of the House and Senate where we live. And frankly, we have a lot better job to do than we have been doing.
This is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here talking to Norman Solomon, media critic, longtime critic of U.S. warfare state. We've been discussing the U.S. warfare state, the continuing military buildup, and through NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the U.S. is encircling Russia. All this wasting huge amounts of the world's resources and increasing the threat of ruinous war, as well as being unsustainable militarily and contributing to the global warming. We might get into that a little bit of that later. Norman, no, tell us, why is this happening? What's the purpose? Who does it serve?
Well, it serves the profits of the military contracting corporations that are literally reaping billions of dollars a year in profits. So it's self-sustaining. And although, as you alluded to, it's destructive ecologically in terms of the future of the planet, it is quite lucrative and profitable for elites. And the news media on the whole, the mass media in the country, are with the program, and with very rare exceptions, elected officials in Congress as well. So it's very bad for the planet, very bad for the people who are low income, who are struggling economically in this country and around the world. It's, you know, the classic misappropriation of resources, what Martin Luther King Jr. called the madness of militarism. And so these dynamics, they're perennial. I remember way back during the Vietnam War in Portland, as around the country, many people were protesting that war. There's no less reason now to be protesting and challenging the militarism that is so corrosive and destructive.
Yeah. It also, it's not just the military industry. It seems to me that the finance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, all of the biggest companies in the United States, they all gain by controlling the politics and organization of the rest of the world. That is, they have to keep countries from, they have to maintain them like the banks. They want to continuously increase their capacity to loan and get paid for U.S. technology or whatever technology they have bought up. It's important for, it seems to me, much of the investor class in U.S. America and the hedge funds and all the rest of the top apparatus to have control of other countries so they don't break from the U.S. set up financial and money-making systems.
Well, there's no doubt. It's access to raw materials. It's access to markets and crashing into and enforcing markets. It's the sort of a loan shark activities of the IMF and the World Bank, various ways that as the financial sector, the transactional financial industries, all of that and more is benefiting from and pushing forward for the military and consequent diplomatic and economic leverage and vice versa that exists. Thomas Friedman, who is supposed to be this great liberal theorist and writer-author that unfortunately many progressives seem to think at least somewhat highly of, he's basically an apologist and an advocate for this kind of policy, and he wrote in his book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, and I'm basically quoting here, he said, to have McDonald's around the world, you need McDonnell Douglas, meaning that to have U.S. corporations more and more effective and dominant around the planet, you need military contractors and weaponry such as that supplied by companies like McDonnell Douglas. So I think ultimately this is a challenge to not only understand what's going on, but to do something about it.
Yeah, it's also, it seems to me, constantly hyping the threat of terrorism and the rest of it, or the Russians or the Iranians even, constantly hyping those threats and promising to protect America. It's a pretty useful, it has been for a very long time, channeling people's...
Well, I certainly agree with you. I certainly agree with you. And the so-called Russian threat, the entire 2+ years we've been subjected to this barrage about Russiagate, where we know that the United States was involved deeply in interfering with and getting the re-election of Boris Yeltsin in 1996. Time magazine had a cover bragging about it, Yanks to the Rescue, with a drawing of Yeltsin on the cover. And then we turn around in a much more minor, from all real indications, much more minor effort from the Russian government to affect the U.S. election in 2016. All of a sudden, you have demagogues claiming on Capitol Hill that it's like Pearl Harbor. You have demagogic pseudo-journalists like Rachel Maddow on MSNBC beating this drum for 2 years, while she's not reporting as a result anywhere near as much as is needed on healthcare, education, housing, racism, anti-immigrant policies. So, frankly, Bill, we have people listening right now who have swallowed the Russiagate stuff full. This is not something that is only being accepted or embraced by, moderate to liberal Democrats. There are many people who view themselves as progressive who have bought this. And I think it's very important to challenge it. If you look at some of the great writing on this subject by Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, what Aaron Mattei has done for The Nation magazine, it's quite debunked. But a lot of folks get into this notion that because Trump is so horrible, and he is, then any worst accusation that is made against him, we're supposed to run with. And it's a electoral loser. We know from polling that very few of the voters give it a priority. People care about, if they're in Flint, they care about what's coming out of their tap. They wonder, can their children go to college and afford to do so? Health care, there's so many issues. And the
whether the planet will survive and their kids,
well,
in fact.
Climate.
To
talk about climate and the idea that, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, we can do it all. No, that's absolutely false. There's only a certain number of minutes on Rachel Maddow's show. She's devoted, according to Fair Study, in some cases, upwards of half of every hour on the average to Russiagate craziness. So this is what we used to call warmongering. Even under a much, much, much more repressive Russian regime under the Soviet Union, liberals were smart enough to applaud when Lyndon Johnson had the Spirit of Glasgow summit with Alexei Kosygin in 1967. So it's time to sort of pull up from the spiral downward that is so dangerous in terms of domestic politics as well as foreign policy.
This is KB Radio. Bill Resnick here talking to Norman Solomon, media critic, longtime critic of U.S. warfare state. We've been discussing the continuing military buildup of the U.S. warfare state, how it's impoverishing the world, creating the conditions for war, actually, and we haven't really talked about that. But any slip-up, any mistake could lead to really a horrible, even nuclear confrontation if they keep this up. And then there's the environmental apocalypse that's being ignored. And it's all enriching the most predatory companies. We discussed that. Norman, you've been working to try and stop the militarization and build a very different country for quite a long time. What do you see as the major ways of confronting this continuing militarization and predation on the world?
One aspect is to support independent progressive media such as KBOO and also challenge the mainline media. I was mentioning MSNBC, but outlets like The Oregonian. We need to challenge the major corporate media organs and outlets as well as build alternatives. And then political action. More and more in the last couple of years, you know, progressives who were even skeptical have seen that you don't get somebody like Rashida Tlaib or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ro Khanna. You don't get them into Congress unless you fight like hell to get them into Congress. And, you know, if you're not happy with somebody is in Congress representing a district out of Oregon or Washington State, then you organize and you develop credible electoral threats, run primary challenges, and get the job done. But it's a tremendously challenging undertaking. It can be done if people set their minds to it collectively.
Yeah, we even can pressure the current Congress, as, for example, in the Yemeni resolutions recently, it came close to passing, of forcing the U.S. from supporting the genocide that the Saudis are perpetrating on Yemen. There's opportunities even right now. I'm sure you agree with that. It's also, it seems to me, absolutely necessary to build movements. An electoral push is important, but it can really suck up all the energy of the left and our movements just trying to win and somehow winning those middle voters in order to then develop an electoral majority. And we sort of lose our way often. It seems to me we really have to build movements that are strong, that help people gain really strong commitments and affiliations at the local level and give people great opportunities to learn about the way they can make a difference.
Well, there's no doubt that these movements, that progressive movements that have always been responsible for what we can be proud of ultimately, the changes don't get initiated or pushed from the top, they get changed from the grassroots and the pressure and the movements. Electoral work is a subset and part of the broader necessity, I think, of the political organizing, education, agitation. And that's an ongoing necessity. You know, I think we've moved well beyond either or. We've moved to yes and in terms of electoral work and other aspects of political movement building. And so I'm quite encouraged that I think we've turned a corner. It's always daunting to go up against the corporate military establishment. And yet I think we have a lot to look forward to if we can just keep at the work.
This is Bill Resnick for KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. It's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Norman Solomon. He's made his book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. He's made the book available for us as a premium in KBOO's membership drive. Norman, thanks a lot for talking. You're free now for changing the world, so keep going.
And you too, and thanks for the invitation.
Okay, so long.
They were singing, ain't no power like the power of the beat, because the power of the beat don't stop. Ain't no power like the power of the beat, because the power of the beat don't stop.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Bill Resnick and Norman Solomon. And we're turning now to our book mole, Larry Bolden.
Good morning. It's nice sometimes to read a book just for the delight of it. When God Was a Rabbit is full of delight as well as some wonderful observations on life. I'm sure a lot of you will remember Judy Blume's wonderful little novel, Are You There, God? It's me, Margaret. Winman's novel is in that lofty company. It's a book about a young girl, Ellie, and her brother, who is 5 years older than she. Oh, and about a rabbit she is given, and without any intention of sacrilege, she names God. Ellie often gets into trouble at church, questioning things she should not. When she asks her mother if God loves everyone, her mother replies, "Of course he does." But her mother is alarmed by the question and questions further. Quote, "Do you want to talk about anything?" she asks quietly, reaching for my hand. She had started to read a book on child psychology from America. It encouraged us to talk about our feelings. It made us want to clam up. "Nope," I said again through a small mouth. It had been a simple misunderstanding. All I had suggested was that Jesus Christ had been a mistake. That was all. An unplanned pregnancy. "Unplanned indeed," screamed the vicar. "And where did you get such blasphemous filth, you ungodly child?" "I don't know," I said, "just an idea." Close quote. When told that God does not love those who question his divine plan, Ellie stops attending church. Her father, a religious skeptic, encourages Ellie's rebellion against religion. "You don't have to go to Sunday school or church for God to love you, or for anyone to love you. You know that, don't you?" And he continues, "You'll understand that as you get older," he added. "But I couldn't wait that long. I'd already resolved that if God couldn't love me, then it was clear I'd have to find one that could." Close quote. After befriending an 80-year-old man in her neighborhood, she decides she'd like to be Jewish. She and her friend, Jenny Penny, and her brother form a hilarious threesome as they skip through their youth. When her father wins a football pool and is suddenly a rich man, his life changes little, except that he buys a new Mercedes with tinted windows. When Ellie's mother insists that the car is not them, says she won't ride in it, and then insists that either the car goes or she does, it ends up that she does. I read this book several weeks ago, and one problem with putting off reviews is that by the time I got to this one, I had forgotten much of the story. Instead of simply going through my underlinings and notes, I started the book over and was as delighted by it on a second reading as on the first. This caused me to recall that whenever I used novels in my classes, I always reread each novel as my students were reading it for the first time, wanting not simply to refresh my memory, but to share in the emotional impact of the books, which I could not do simply by writing a description. Winman was an actress before she became a writer, and it is obvious in the script quality of her dialogue. She says of her switch to writing, "There was no great epiphany, no precise moment when I swapped the spoken word for the written word. I'd been acting for 23 years and had always written, but mainly in script form, as most actors do." Close quote. Fortunate for us readers that she decided to write fiction, and fortunate too that her debut novel was this coming-of-age tale. While simply a lovely frolic for the most part, there are also darker passages when Ellie describes the very different home life of her best friend, Jenny Penny. The simplicity of the writing makes believable that it is the story of a young girl, but it also allows for a really lovely naivete, a refreshing and revealing innocence. Ellie tells us that she divides her life into two parts, the first before she met Jenny Penny, and the rest after that friendship began to blossom. Quoting again from the book, "She featured not at all during this early period, and I realized she was the color that was missing. She clasped the years either side of this waiting and held them up as beacons, and when she arrived in class that dull January morning, it was as if she herself was the new year, the thing that offered me the promise of beyond. But only I could see that. Others, bound by convention, found her at best laughable and at worst someone to mock. She was of another world, different. But by then, secretly, so was I. She was my missing piece, my complement in play." Close quote. Ellie could have been describing herself here rather than Penny, and for this reader, she opens up a new and refreshing world. I've been talking about Sarah Winman's 2011 novel, When God Was a Rabbit. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Song was Rabbit Run by The Rabbits, courtesy of the Free Music Archive. Thanks, Larry Bolden, for that review of Sarah Winman's novel, When God Was a Rabbit. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle. Thank you to everyone who's made today's show happen. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg for engineering. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Norman Solomon for their conversation about U.S. militarism and propaganda.
Thanks to Larry Bolden for his review of When God Was a Rabbit by Sarah Winman. Thanks to John Nilsson for editing, and to KBOO listeners and members and volunteers and staff for all they do. Thanks to you for calling and supporting KBOO. In a day or two, you'll be able to find this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour through our page at kboo.fm, along with relevant links and transcripts of some of the pieces. While you're at our page, you can also find links to like and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and to subscribe to the show so you can share it with your friends. Listen again. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m. Now, you'll want to stay tuned to KBOO. At 10 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein talks with Kevin Walker, whose new book, The Grand Food Bargain and the Mindless Drive for More, looks at the global consequences of America's modern food system. And at 11, it's First Voices Radio with host Yotsin Ghosthorse. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. To support our spring membership drive, just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate, or pick up that phone and call 877-500-5266. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being human.